And welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm Ann Gordon here with my friend and chavruta Yordana Azband. Our daf of the day, Masechet Bava Metzia, daf lamed hey, page 35. We have a Mishnah coming up on Amud Bet. That's Yordana, you're going to handle that. I want to start at the top of Amud Aleph, from nearly the very top of Amud Aleph. We're talking about this oath, right? We've talked about how a person who's the guardian, the protector of whatever's been left in his for him to watch, can either pay back something that is, again, lost or stolen, or he can take an oath. And so the Gemara says, you know, we're talking about the case of where there's a concern that there's a need for the oath, and it switches from the debtor to the creditor, who's going to take it. So the Gemara says, really quite close to the top of the daf, it says, Ihachi, Mehecha Maitila. If so, right, where do we get it that he's going to bring it? What does it mean he's going to bring it? He's going to bring the collateral, right? If there's no worry that the creditor is going to produce the collateral, well, then at that point, isn't that when the oath transfers from the debtor to the creditor? Ela Amar Rav Yosef, Sheyesh Edim Shenigneva. Rav Yosef said, no, we're talking about a case where there are witnesses that the collateral was stolen. So that's a sure thing. It's not, you're not testing him whether it was stolen. So the Gemara says, again, like, so then still, how will we know that how will it be possible for the creditor to bring that collateral if it's been stolen? The Tarach Umaitila. So the Gemara says, well, yes, it was stolen, but the creditor can then like work hard to go find the thief and bring, you know, somehow get the collateral back to prove, right? This is, you know, going to the nth degree to prove that the debtor who had taken this oath beforehand, you know, to say, oh, I wasn't negligent. To say that he wasn't negligent, but then that's a false oath. So the Gemara says, Ihachi, ki mishtaba malvenami litrach lova v'leite. So the Gemara says, well, if that's the case, then the creditor, right, the lender, could also take that oath, and then let the debtor, right, the person who borrowed, to go exert himself and bring back this collateral thing. And then, therefore, it will be clear that the creditor took the false oath. Meaning, why does it have to be only in the other direction? Either way, each one of them could have been the one to take it upon himself to go find the item that was the proof, right, that was going to stand in the stead of the oath to prove that the oath was false. So the Gemara says, Bishlama Malva, Yada Man Ka'ail V'nafak B'Vitek. The Gemara says, no, that's not going to happen. The debtor is not really going to go make that effort. Because, yeah, sure, it's possible that the creditor would then go and want to recover, right, the thing that was stolen, right? Because he knows, he's paying attention to what's happening with people coming in and out of his house. He maybe could figure out, this is Ayel Vanafi, go in and go out of his house. Va'azel V'tarach U'maitila, he could maybe figure out who the thief was and go and, you know, with some effort, find the collateral. Mi'adam man Ayel V'nafik B'feitei D'malva. But how could you figure that out with the debtor? Meaning, how can the debtor figure out who's going in and out of the creditor's house? He can't figure out who the thief is going to be. So then, like the Gemara is saying, it's not logical to think that the debtor would be able to do this same kind of exertion to find the conclusion, to find the, you know, the actual item, and then prove, in fact, that the creditor had taken a false oath if that's what happened. Now, Abai has an interesting comment here, which is kind of why I wanted to talk about this. Abai Omer, Abai says that, yes, the creditor takes an oath that he doesn't have the collateral in his possession. And so, therefore, we're talking about, then that's what kicks the obligation for the oath over. It gets it from the debtor to the creditor, right? Because why? They've made this decree. What's the decree? To make sure that the debtor will take the oath for the partial, for if he's done any kind it's a little more complicated than I want to delve into, but the point is that if the debtor takes the oath, then the creditor has the claim, and he can then go and say to him, I found the collateral after you took the oath. Meaning, this issue of whether the oath was something that was false gets it's not so easily presented as false, because the creditor, the same way he could say, I went and I found the thief and I got the collateral and now I've proven your oath false, he also could just say, oh, I found it, right? Because if he finds it, it doesn't necessarily mean that the oath is false. Somewhere along the way, we run into this kind of, you know, the conflict between the oath, even if it's not false, and the collateral, where is it? Rav Ashi Amar, Zenishba v'zenishba, Zenishba sheino b'shuto, v'zenishba kama hayashava. So Rav Ashi wants to streamline this, and he says, no, instead of having this conflict between which oath and who owns what, who's got his hands on the collateral, then both of them have to take an oath. The creditor takes an oath specifically that he does not have the collateral in his possession. So then the debtor's oath is upheld, but the debtor takes an oath to how much the collateral itself is going to be worth or would have been worth. Okay. So now the question is, who's going to take the oath first? Malva nishbatchila shema yishava ze biotzi hala et apikadon. So the Gemara explains, and this is going back to our Mishnah, right? Who takes the oath first? That the creditor takes the oath first, namely that the collateral is not in his possession, so that the debtor can't then come and take an oath and after he's taken the oath, lo and behold, the creditor could bring out the deposit, the collateral. So we end up with a situation where these parties are really in opposition to each other in ways that I think are not necessarily expected, because it's not so simple as to say, oh, you have my thing, you need to give it back. I did give it back. I didn't give it back. It was stolen. Right? We can come up with all of these permutations, but at the end of the day, when they're both having to take an oath, you would think, doesn't that put them on equal footing? And even then, the creditor really could make not only a fool, but make him, you know, it could end up being a false oath for no, like almost inadvertently, because of to claim that he doesn't have the collateral, but then lo and behold, he can produce it, right? That puts the debtor on uneven ground. Okay, the Gemara goes on to do a little bit more analysis of what's going on in the Mishnah. I want to jump to a little further down, still on Amud Aleph. It says, "Hahu gavra da'afkid kifi gabe chavre." We have a person who leaves, who deposits for safekeeping, jewels with another person. Amarle havli kefi. So then after this time of collateral, like however long it was supposed to be, that he was leaving the jewels with that other person, he comes back and he says to the shomer, he says, give me my jewels. Amarle lo yadani hechi otvinehu. He says, I don't know where I put them. Right? He's not saying you didn't do it. You never left them here. He's saying, I don't know where they are. Atalakame de Rav Nachman. So now the case comes before Rav Nachman. Amarle kol loyadana peshuata hi. Anytime a shomer says, I don't know where I put them, that in and of itself is negligence. And this, I think, is an important point, and it takes us back even to Baba Kama, right? This idea that anybody who's it's not yet damaged, right? The jewels might be in great shape, but it's negligence on the part of the person who's supposed to be taking care of them. Zil shleim, lo shleim, azil Rav Nachman agabe lavdana mine. So Rav Nachman says to the shomer, go pay him for the jewels, go pay the original owner. But then the shomer doesn't pay. So Rav Nachman goes and gives instructions that they should repossess, you know, his palace, whatever, his home, in order to sell it to pay for the jewels that he, oops, misplaced. Lesof, ishtakach, kefe, of course, I don't know if it's an of course, but it feels of course. In the end, they find the jewels. The shomer finds the jewels, and not only that, va'aykor, they've gotten more valuable in all of this time. Amar Rav Nachman, hadri kefi le marayhu, v'hadar apadano le mara. So the jewels have to go back to the initial owner, and the home, the palace, really, again, the word here is palace, but it's returned to the original owner, returned to its owner, right, the shomer. But the shomer does not get the benefit of the increase in the value of the jewels. Okay. The Gemara goes on with Rav Nachman and Rava, as a student before Rav Nachman's judgment of this kind of thing. I think the hierarchy here is also interesting, that Rav Nachman really does seem to be the authority in many, many, many of these cases. He clearly was an activist here, right? To say, like, no, you have to pay back the jewels, the value of the jewels, and we're going to go to great lengths to make sure that you have done so.
I mean, I think part of what's interesting here is it's not just about watching the object. There's a whole other level of halacha, like what happens afterwards, having to take a shvuah, like all the different ways that this gets played out. It's not just, it's kind of like the consequences is more interesting than the actual interaction between the person borrowing or watching the object and the owner of the object.
I think that's true. I'm much more interested in these stories around them rather than just the straight up cases, which maybe isn't fair to the halacha, but.
All right, I'm going to move on. There is a Mishnah on Amud Bet. I just want to point to right before the Mishnah, the Gemara kind of goes through a series. I'm not going to read it all. It's sort of like interesting cases of things that can happen once the property has been seized. Right. So it starts off, by saying Amar Nahardai, right? The Nahardian scholars would say Shuma Hadar, right? Seize properties return when the debtor offers money. Ad Treya Sar Yachay Shata, up to 12 months following the seizure. But Amar Mamar, now Mamar said, Ana mi Nahardai, Ana, I am from Naharda, Usfirale Shuma Hadar Lolam. And yet I say that seized properties return forever. In other words, once the debtor can pay off the debt, they get the seized property back. The Hilchatash Shuma hadar la'olam. And the halacha is that seized property can be returned forever. Mishum shenemar. And here they quote a pasuk from Devarim chapter 6, verse 18. Vasita yashar v'tov. You shall do what is right and is good. So even though the creditor legally acquires the seized property, he's obligated to return it in exchange for the money. Now they go through some cases where there could be like a secondary creditor, right? Pshita. Right? If the court sees property for a creditor, and then the creditor went and gave the property to his own creditor, right? So that if the debtor wanted to give, cash to the creditor, we tell the second creditor, you're no better than from the man who your claim derives. In other words, just as the first creditor would have to return the property, the second creditor has to return the property, even though the first creditor gave the money, gave the property to the second creditor for his debt. Then Zabna, right? If the creditor basically later sold it, Orta, right? Or was left as an inheritance, the Yahabe b'matana, or he gave it as a present, and then the debtor comes and offers a cash for payment. So again, it's not that it went to another creditor, but the creditor got rid of the property either by selling it or by giving it as to inheritance or as a present. Certainly these three, the secondary owners, they entered into the property with the intent of acquiring land. And they didn't intend with the intent of acquiring money. So actually in those cases, because it's not a creditor situation, they actually do not need to return they don't need to return the property, which is actually very interesting. In other words, if it's creditor to creditor, a creditor always needs to worry that, like, maybe he'll have to give that property back. He's only taking the property instead of money. But when you're talking about somebody who buys it, or an heir, or somebody who's given it as a present, they intended to acquire the property. They didn't want money, and that's why this doesn't apply to them, and they actually don't have to return it. Then it goes on to say, Shamula li'isha vi'ich nisiva, right? Let's say the court sees property from a woman and then she got married. O shamu mine di'isha vi'ich nisiva, or they seized property from a woman and then she got wed. Umeta, and then she died. Ba'al nichnase ishto lo ke'achave. Since a husband is considered a purchaser with her property, right? In other words, he gets her property when she dies. Lo mehadar, he doesn't need to return it. Below Mahadrinan lay, and we don't return the property to him, even if he's offered cash. And then the Gemara gives the what's the source for this? To Amar Rav Yosi Bar Chanina, Buusha Hitkinu, and Usha. Now remember, Usha is one of the Tanaitic cities. And it was one of the places where the big Sanhedrin sat when it had to move around a bunch at the time of the Roman persecutions. And it's in the Galil. And they made a takana, Hayishasha machrab nichnise mulug b'chaye balat. If a woman sells mulug property in her husband's lifetime, okay? So remember, mulug property is property that a husband gets profit from. And so the point is she can't sell her husband's right to profit that mulug property. So if she sells the mulug property, umeta, and then dies, habal motzi miyad halukuchot, the husband can actually take the property from the possession of the purchasers, right? Because she really couldn't have sold it because he was entitled to the mulug, to the profit that he would have gotten. And then the Gemara is going to go on from here until the Mishnah, and it gives a few other cases like this. I think it's just interesting to see the variety of cases. Like, there's so many different cases because we basically know that land does transfer hands, and it comes to people in different ways. And it can't just be that, you know, anytime you buy or, you know, get a piece of property, that it automatically would have to be returned. That nobody would want to buy or sell anything because there always would be a fear of that. So, but I think the variety of cases is really interesting.
I think the variety of cases is interesting. It's another example to me of how the halakha kind of has to be in place because otherwise, even the good people that you would think would never pull shenanigans still might. So there's the law to kind of protect everybody in regular things, in everyday kind of circumstances. Okay. I mean, that's all.
Okay, I'm moving on to a Mishnah, and we already have another Mishnah here. And this Mishnah talks about cases where the shomer can actually profit from the item that's left with him. So somebody rents a cow from his fellow, and then the renter lent it to another person during the rental, and then it died a natural death. The renter swears to the owner that the cow died naturally, right? So he's not liable of anything. Right? Because remember, a renter is not liable for sort of an unavoidable, you know, loss. And the borrower, right, actually has to pay the value of the cow to the renter. I mean, think about what that is. It's kind of crazy. So the renter, like, makes out great in this scenario. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says, Ketzad hala osa schora. How can the renter do business b'parato shel chaveiro, right? You rented something, you're not allowed to borrow it, like lend it to somebody else, right? That's his question. So, you know, that doesn't really make sense there, right? Ella tachzor para labalim. Rather, the value of the cow should be returned to the owner. So I think Rabbi Yossi's opinion makes a lot more sense. The Gemara is going to start off by trying to explain the reasoning of the Mishnah. Amar le Rav Idi bar Avin la Abaye. So Rav Idi bar Avin said to Abaye, Mirte socher b'may kani lahai para. Now, with what act did the renter acquire the cow that he then is entitled to the borrower's payment, right? Bishfua, it's with the oath, right? When he takes the oath that the cow died of natural causes, then he sort of gets the borrower's payment from that. That's how he acquires it. V'nemele maskir lesocher, but let the owner tell the renter, dalanit v'dal shvuatach, right? Eliminate yourself and you eliminate your oath. In other words, I release you from your liability. V'ana mishtina dina b'hade shoel. And I'll litigate this with the borrower so he can get his money back. Amrlei Abaye says to him, "Mi sabar tzocher b'shvuachu deka kanile." Do you think that it's with an oath that the renter acquires the cow? Mishat meitahu dekani. No, he acquires it actually from the time of the animal's death. Ushvua, and the oath is there kedei lahafis dato shel ba'al habayit, in order to appease the owner so that he won't say that the renter did something that was negligent. So it's basically impossible for the owner to prevent the renter from getting the cow, from getting that money with the borrower's payment, which is kind of fascinating. Then from the get there, the Gemara is going to go on to, a bunch of different cases or sort of consequences based on the Mishnah. And they're actually very interesting. You know, if you rented a cow for 100 days and the rent, and then someone else borrowed it, you know, the renter used it for 90 days and then borrowed it to somebody for 80 of those 90 days, like, they get into all these different cases that are very interesting from there.
So I want to know, how often were people really borrowing and lending cows, right? Like, I feel like nowadays, let's say the equivalent is a car. So some people will lend and borrow very easily, and some people are very cautious because they're nervous about, you know, the liability, the responsibility. So I feel like I can understand where one might take on that responsibility, like, because a cap was a big deal, right? A big expense in the event of something going wrong. So in my head, I can kind of transfer that to the cap, to the car issue that one might have nowadays. But I kind of also have this question of, were they really borrowing cows as a regular thing?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. And like, I have lent my car to people, but I would be livid if someone lent my lent car to somebody else.
Right. Like, that's part of the terms, right? The expectation is that you don't.
Exactly. I don't know. It's an interesting, and I think it's interesting to see what the Gemara is going to do with this. I understand Rabbi Yossi. The Tanna Kamma does not really make sense to me. Well, that's our DAF discussion for the day. Rank us, review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. Let us know what you thought about this topic on our Talking Talmud Facebook page. And until tomorrow, go and learn.